couple of ways you could go about this kind of process. You could say, let's analyze everything and then choose which ones we'll look at. It becomes rather unwieldy and would take quite a long time to analyze 300 options thoroughly for every state. And so rather than do that, what we generally do is suggest that they cast a broad net on the measures, come up with the ones that look the best to them or ought to be considered, and then prioritize. And it's after the prioritization, and after we get a sense from the group what each policy option ought to look like in Minnesota, because that we actually do the analysis. And let me just give an example. A cap-and-trade program, for example. Benchmarks to them based on our experience in other states. So we'll say a measure is either a high emissions reduction, has high potential, medium potential, or low potential. In terms of cost, we'll say it's high or medium or low. And we use those general benchmarks to give some guidance, but not, because it varies from state to state, we don't want to be so detailed that they end up ruling out options that would ultimately end up to be great for one state.
Representative Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Litz. I'm seeing that you have, looking west, plans underway and plans completed in Washington, Oregon, California, Idaho, Montana. And I believe it's correct to say that there's state policies that do not provide for the construction of conventional coal plants in California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. On the 14th of May last session, the state of Montana passed a law saying any construction requires 50% sequestration. Plans completed in California and Oregon, did they take into account the recommendations of your group work in those two states as they made those laws? And since Washington, Idaho actually did no new coal in a special session during the 2006 summer, and now that Montana has the sequestration requirement, I'm wondering, if with those laws enacted, what climate change plans we might be seeing from those three Northern Rockies and Pacific Northwest states as to how it relates to pending plans for two coal plants within the upper Midwest region, namely Big Stone 2 and Excelsior.
Mr. Liss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We worked with the state of Oregon. We did not work with the state of California. So although I am fairly familiar with how California has gone about their planning, the advisory group process is meant to cast a very broad net and identify potential options. Prohibiting new coal plants was not one of the options that the advisory group came up with. It could have been. I suppose it still could be. And so, in terms of the Minnesota process ongoing, that has not been identified as. At this point, I'd say it's unlikely that it would come out as a recommendation at the other end of the process, unless somebody raises it between now and the end. It was also not part of the report in Oregon or the two South. Arizona or New Mexico. I can't speak to what it would do in terms of the emissions. We'd have to quantify it because you'd have to figure out where you would get your energy from in lieu of not having coal, and then what the impact of that would be, and score it out. And I hope that answers your question, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it does. And it's also good to see on the state climate goals that there's now a state of Puget Sound. Scandinavian-endorsed free trade union folks in Puget Sound are definitely working hard.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, thanks for letting me ask another question. What Representative Peterson was just bringing up makes me wonder what you have some basic assumptions. You just said that if you didn't count a new coal, you'd have to revise your forecast. So you're basing you have some kind of a baseline forecast about how much new energy from different sources are expected in Minnesota?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Liss.
Yes, Senator. There is the forecast is based on a model that's used by the Energy Information Agency, EIA, in Washington called NEMS. And NEMS projects where the electricity sector will go going forward. Now, before I even say anything else, I should say that that's one of the issues that's been raised by your group here in the state. They want to look very closely at the projections in the electricity sector. So I suspect that what we have now in the forecast is likely to change.
Senator Anderson.
And Madam Chair, I mean, obviously you're aware of our renewable energy standard we passed last session, and we're hoping that's going to make a big difference in the future. I guess I would just ask you if the members of the group have been advised about the recent approval of the Big Stone plant, because to me it seems kind of like a slap in the face to all this work that they're doing, that suddenly they've been handed this new additional job that they have to do, making their job that much harder. Right in the middle of this process of trying to figure out how to reduce emissions, suddenly their heavy lifting is going to get a lot heavier.
Mr. Liss.
Senator, we have not met since that settlement agreement came out. The advisory group has not met. They meet again September 27th. And we have also not taken, we have not worked that into the forecast process. So in figuring out how it's going to affect the forecast, although I can assure you that we will, because when you do look at, if you do diverge from the EIA forecast that I mentioned and do something that's a little bit more organic from a Minnesota perspective, and we refer to projections that are, or forecasts that are bottom-up analyses, which refers to you look at the ground, basically, and build up your forecast based on what you know is happening here on the ground, then things like that will actually specifically get considered in the forecast. And just one last comment. The forecast, it does, of course, speak to what you're up against in terms of getting reductions. So once you have a forecast that you think is reliable and robust, you then measure your ability to meet your goals against that forecast.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on Senator Anderson's question just to make sure that I'm getting this straight. What you will do is analyze how much additional carbon will come in from this recent recommendation, which is not, you know, set in stone now, but a recommendation. And then you'll be able to tell us who else will have to pay in the economy, because you're doing this broad economic analysis, who has to pay to reduce because this South Dakota group is raising their carbon. So we will, in the end, be able to see the cost to Minnesotans of this increase in carbon. Am I getting that right,
Mr. Liss?
Chair. Representative, I think you have that partly right, but let me say it before I answer the question again, and I probably should have prefaced my last answer the same way. I and the Center do not decide what the forecast will ultimately look like. The Climate Change Advisory Group will decide that, and they have raised issues about the forecast, as I mentioned, and seem to be favoring a more bottom-up approach where you look at specific factors like a new plant build, or as it's referred to, a new plant that may not have been in the national forecast that we started with. So assuming that the CCAG does want to do a forecast in that way, then you will see that plant considered in the forecast. And because the whole set of measures that come from the group will be all the policy actions will be scored against the forecast. You will be able to draw your own conclusions about what particular aspects about the forecast, the bearing that they have on your ability to meet your goals. Is that?
No.
No?
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I think to be useful, we need to know that if we're introducing a lot more carbon, somebody else is going to have to pay to reduce. And we need to be able to have that quantified so we understand who is paying for this increase. I mean, it's a fairly straightforward thing, because then we may say, well, that increase is not so good because somebody else is paying. And we have to have a pretty straightforward analysis of that, and it's just making sure that we are getting that straightforward analysis, and that's my question. Just, are we going to get a straightforward analysis?
Mr. List?
Madam Chair, thank you. It's captured in the analysis. That's what I'm trying to say. Plans like that would be captured in a bottom-up analysis, but there are lots of other factors that are in the forecast as well. Any other planned build that might be in the state, or planned retirement or uprate, or even not just in the state but in the region, you'd have to take that into account. And all of those factors go into your forecast, which tells you then what you're up against. You're absolutely right. When you increase emissions in one area, it does affect your forecast, and it will affect your ability to, it will potentially affect your ability to reduce emissions. But when the final analysis is done, it's left to each individual to decide which aspects, which drivers, which factors in the forecast are what's causing the challenge. Do you follow me? Or does that answer? Does that help?
Representative Wagenius.
Well, we will see what's driving the challenge. We will see this much carbon introduced. What I am hoping we can see from you is somebody wins, and then who loses? Who has to pay additional reductions to make up for that increase in carbon?
Mm-hmm. Mr. List.
David has provided me another way to state this. To the extent that that plant increases the projected emissions attributable to Minnesota, then that plant will make it harder to reach your reduction goals, almost by definition. So that's any factor that increases emissions will make it harder, and I think generally you could say more expensive to reduce your emissions.
What, Representative Kalin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the indulgence letting me ask a couple of questions. I actually thought that I didn't have any yet for this portion, but the longer that we've been talking about forecasting, the more questions I've got, and I imagine that's what you've been getting with the larger group as well. I'm trying to figure out how the 2007 Act, especially with the efficiency conservation goal, how it's involved in the forecasting, because this baseline is obviously the critical piece in measurement. The more that I'm hearing, the less and less I'm convinced that there's about how it's being handled. Just so, is this 1.5% goal? Like, we've been working under the assumption that the growth curve is about 2.1 to 2.5% in electrical consumption, mm-hmm. and that then we have this annual statewide goal of 1.5% reduction from that. But if we're working from a NEMS forecast, the national forecast, I think it sounds like you have some beginning answers to this question. So I'll guess I'll wait to hear what you have to say and then see if there's some follow-up clarification.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Thornton.
Representative, these are exactly some of the kinds of questions that the group is wrestling with. In general, I believe that the group has landed on using around 2005 as the starting point for things, that anything that has happened before that is a part of the base case. Business as usual that would result in that line that Franz showed on one of his slides that showed the projected increase in emissions in Minnesota. So, for example, the 10% ethanol requirement would be a part of the base case. So what we're looking at is how rapidly that line increases over time. That would be what percent increase. And that there's a lot of factors that go into that. What is going to be the population increase in the state? How many more vehicle miles traveled will we have in the state? What will ultimately be the amount of electricity that people are going to be using? And then from that, we're going to try to analyze what the renewable energy standard, what benefits the renewable energy standard that was passed will make to that base case line, and what benefits the efficiency requirements will make from that base case line. And then we'll be working from there, looking at additional measures that would be needed in order to meet the goals that the legislature has set. Did that help at all?
Representative Kaelin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it does help somewhat. I think the next question, I appreciate that no assumptions are being made about achieving goals, especially on the efficiency piece, that these are goals that we have a lot of work to do to implement. Even the 1% floor for each utility is going to be a real stretch from what we heard, since I think we're starting to raise some questions about how much of a stretch that actually is. But so I guess I'll just pay real close attention and engage in some of the dialogue to just understand how those assumptions are being made. But it's encouraging to know that there's some extremely critical thought being made. I think it's very important for the public and stakeholders to understand that no assumptions are being made here, and that no assumptions should be made anywhere in terms of performance and reaching these goals and the standard.
Madam Chair, one thing that we could talk about doing, if it's appropriate, is to come back at the time that we are a little bit closer to having a final inventory and forecast and share and discuss some of the things that went into that. It sounds like the group might be interested in that.
Yes, and it's obvious that you have a work in progress and that we've got a long ways to go yet, and we'll be interested in hearing from you in the future. And I'm going to allow Representative Beard another question, but after that I think we need to move on. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, members, I think it's more of a comment than a question as I'm listening to this give and take and concern about what assumptions are going into your baseline. I'm looking ahead on slide 28. It talks about your reference cases assume no major changes from business as usual. And then again on page 30, you have some little disclaimers about the key points and so that you're going to be making and the things that you're not going to be, that we shouldn't be paying attention to. But back to the business as usual, I believe in the global warming mitigation bill that we passed at the end of last session, we specifically carved out three exemptions that I hope you include in your assumptions. The Excelsior project, of which I'm very fond, the Big Stone project, and I think the major steel plant on the Iron Range, I think those were exemptions that were carved out because I believe the assumption was they were already underway and necessary for the economic vitality of the state. So certainly those would be in your baseline, I would think, and I don't think you should be ashamed to acknowledge that that's there. So just an observation as we're wrestling with what's there and what's not. And perhaps you'll talk about it again on slide 28.
Did you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, just very briefly. When I referred to what you see here on these slides is how the initial forecast was done. And as I've mentioned in response to some other questions, there is a desire on the part of some of the Climate Advisory Group members to take a more bottom-up approach where you actually look at a case-by-case, at these specific cases, And you build your forecast based on what you actually expect to happen on the ground. And when that happens, assuming it does, those three examples that you mentioned would necessarily have to be taken into account.
Okay, Mr. Thornton, Mr. List, thank you very much for the information. We'll be interested in hearing from you in future meetings.
Madam Chair.
Just an example of how that individual transferable quotas in fisheries would work.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Sure. If the Fisheries Management Agency and this is what they actually do on both coasts now. They'll figure out what's a sustainable harvest in a particular fishery, and so they'll set the overall aggregate quota for the fisheries. They then issue individual transferable quotas to the fishermen, and say each quota allows them to harvest a certain amount of the marine resource, catch a certain amount of fish, basically. And overall, they're allowed to, they can trade that to another fisherman, and the idea is that the resource is harvested in the most economically efficient way, because the quotas will end up in the hands of those who can most cost-effectively harvest the resource. At the same time, you're managing to keep the aggregate catch in a particular fishery no higher than what the government has decided is a sustainable level.
Madam Chair, so
Senator Chaudhry,
there might be an individual fishery that is perhaps higher than that, what that one individual fishery could sustain due to higher transfer quotas in that instance. Is that possible?
Mr. Liss?
I suppose it is possible. There, like, one area of the fishery area could be fished more heavily than previously, and that is sometimes referred to as hot spots in the air pollution context. It would be I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at, but
yeah.
To transfer it to the carbon context, what you're doing with a carbon cap and trade program is you're saying the atmosphere will tolerate a certain amount of emissions. That's where we're going to set our cap level. And beyond that, the regulatory authority doesn't worry too much about where the permits ultimately end up. They're just concerned about never exceeding that maximum threshold. So it's comparable in that sense.
Madam Chair, last question.
Senator Chaudhry.
The people who fish or live around Big Stone Lake, for example, might be concerned about particular emissions or acid rain deposits into their particular lake. Isn't that true?
Liss?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, I believe, Senator, that you're thinking in terms of localized impacts of a potential market-based program, and that concern has been lodged in many of these examples. So, for example, emissions cap and trade with respect to sulfur dioxide. In New York State, where I worked for the Pollution Control Agency, we were very concerned about acid rain coming from Midwest plants. And even though it was under a cap and trade, the cap and trade didn't really address the localized impacts. However, tradable credit by exceeding the standard, which I can in turn sell to a producer who may not be in a position to improve the carbon profile cheaply. So overall, it does accomplish the goal at a lower cost.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, to the consumer.
Mr. Liss.
I'd have to say that it would depend on the you'd have to analyze that in each case as to what the cost would be to the consumer, whether there would be a net cost or a reduction.
And wouldn't somebody in a position with a large number of credits be in a very good position to sell these credits at a very high premium?
Mr. Liss.
Madam Chair, the hoarding of these commodities and these market-based mechanisms is a concern that's often raised, not just in the low-carbon fuel standard context, but in the cap-and-trade context. The reason, I guess what I can say in response, is that there are existing programs out there, the sulfur dioxide program. In the Northeast, we had a nitrogen oxides cap-and-trade, and there is a European cap-and-trade for greenhouse gases, and hoarding has not been observed to manipulate price.
Well, and Madam Chair, then what's been the ultimate result as far as the price is concerned to the consumer?
Madam Chair, with respect to the low-carbon fuel standard, that's still being designed. It's a relatively new idea, and it's not yet in place in California. So I can't speak to what the result of it will be as yet. There are a number of studies that California has undertaken in an attempt to analyze that. And I can get it to you.
Well, Madam Chair, when you get to the cap and trade, could you tell me about it then?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Litz, my questions follow along the good senator's questions. You talk about the standards being developed. Who is developing the standards? What criteria are we using here?
Mr. Litz.
Who's in charge of that program?
The low-carbon fuel standard in California is an initiative of the governor himself, and it's being coordinated right out of his office, and I can give you contacts of the people.
Representative Beard.
Governor Schwarzenegger.
I was hoping, Madam Chair, members, for something more objective, I guess. What I'm concerned about is exactly what Senator Tomasoni was asking about. The European situation with cap and trade, I understand, actually has been a mess, with huge amounts of wealth being transferred to the power companies, of all things, who somehow amassed huge credits, and we're not really sure how that happened. I understand it's a new concept, maybe not a natural result of a marketplace, but we're going to try to make this work, so we're going to walk our way through it. It would be useful, I think, to learn from that mess and how do we apply it here. But I guess as a free market guy, what I want to know is there objective criteria that sets what a low-carbon standard is, or is it something that we make up at the committee here, God help us, and assign a price to that? The standards are what I think are really crucial to this whole thing and how it works and who starts off the program with a whole boatload of them and how they go from there.
Madam Chair, I will return to the EU ETS, the EU trading schemes issues when I go through the cap and trade.
Oh, you will. Good. Okay. We can hear about that some more then.
I wasn't going to, but I will because of your question.
Let's continue then.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Now, I just want to compare a carbon tax to a cap and trade here. Now, a carbon tax, of course, the charge per ton versus a cap and trade where you're establishing an aggregate limit on emissions from a certain set of sources. On the carbon tax side, your emissions reductions are somewhat uncertain. On the cap and trade side, your focus is on emissions reductions, and they're very certain. With a carbon tax, you know what your price is going to be because that's what the tax sets. It sets your price per ton. With a cap and trade, you're leaving the price up to the forces of supply and demand. There are ways to project and analyze what the price might be, but it's not as certain as a carbon tax. On the other hand, a carbon tax you don't really know what emission reductions you're going to get because it's a function of firms will reduce their emissions, but only as long as it's cheaper than paying the tax. Otherwise, they'll just pay the tax. They both are market signals that drive emissions reductions, and they're both potential sources of revenue that can be used in a state or a region or a country to for complementary purposes or for rebates to consumers or reductions in other tax loads. I'm going to just quickly go through the basic building blocks of a cap and trade here. And as I do, I'm going to reference the European context, because I think they made some mistakes in the design of their program that go back to the basics. The first thing you do is identify the sources you want covered, and you could have the Northeast Red Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which I was involved in, of course, focused just on the electric sector. The Western states, and I'm engaged now as one of the advisors to that process, the Western states are looking to expand their cap and trade beyond the electric sector to make it economy-wide. The extent of that is not yet known. They'll have to decide which sectors to add to the program and when. Once you decide what sources you're covering, you need to make sure that you know where you're starting from. And this is where the Europeans went wrong. You have to have good, solid emissions information. That's a little different from what I'm talking about here. You're in the cap and trade context, you're required to go out and demonstrate a reduction that's the equivalent of a reduction that you could get right at the plant. So that's the goal. Quickly from the perspective of the source, because I find that this makes it a lot easier to understand what a cap and trade is. If I'm a source covered by a cap and trade, what are my requirements? How do I look at a program like this? I essentially have two requirements. On the one hand, I have to measure my emissions, monitor, and report my emissions to the government. So over time, I have a running tally of my emissions, and that tally is held in a government account called the emissions account. On the other hand, I know that at the end of the compliance period, I must hold enough of these government-issued allowances to cover my emissions. So I'm keeping track on one hand of my emissions tally, and on the other hand, I'm planning to make sure that I have enough allowances to cover those emissions. And at the end of the compliance period, I know that if my allowance balance in my allowance account is at least as big or greater than my emissions balance in my emissions account, then I'm in compliance. I know that allowances are freely tradable. So as I'm doing that planning to make sure that my emissions are covered by allowances, I can plan by going out and identifying other sources that may have an excess in allowances, and I can lock those allowances up in agreements, in trading agreements. Another way to look at it is, well, if I have a reduction, if I'm facing a reduction, how do I comply with that reduction? Well, of course, the plant can reduce its emissions. And what we often hear is, well, gee, there's no viable stack scrubber for carbon, so how do they do that? Let me point out a couple of ways that's been used in existing programs. In both REGI and in the EU, burning biomass or biofuel as a part of your fuel used in a plant has been considered a way of complying. So if you're using a carbon-neutral fuel for 10% of your fuel, you've thereby reduced your emissions by 10% or perhaps more or less, depending on the emissions factor of the fuel. But that's one way to comply. There are ways you can build your cap and trade to give your sources options to reduce emissions that are other than putting on innovative scrubber technologies. But those innovative scrubber technologies are another way to reduce. You can also buy allowances from another source that's taken one of those paths, and you can buy offset credits. So you'll see in the discussion about the cap and trade that offsets is a big part of it. It's seen as a key part to be able to have flexibility to comply.
Senator Kubley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Vest. So is a carbon neutral operation, and is that considered to be a baseline, or could the baseline be set at something that's actually carbon negative?
Mr. List.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It could be set wherever you want to. You'd be in control of your own rules. In the REGI context, I can say that a carbon-neutral power plant would have no obligation under the program. So if they burned sustainably harvested biomass for 100% of its fuel, it would have no compliance obligation. And not only that, it would get RPS credit. They'd be able to sell the energy credits that are associated with it.
All right.
But where you set the rules is completely up to you. You could make them have to go further than that, if that's what you wanted. And then just a couple of notes on regional cap and trade programs. I just noted up there when you saw the states in the upper Midwest that had done climate change plans. There are four states, including Minnesota, in the upper Midwest who are moving on this issue. And so thinking about regional approaches in the upper Midwest or approaches that tie the state to other regions, whether it's in the Northeast or the Western states process, may make some sense as an option to consider. The benefits, of course, of a regional program is that you add more sources. And the more sources you have covered by a cap, the more likely you're going to find the low-hanging fruit. You're going to find innovation. If I'm a developer of new technology, if the market is bigger, and say if I know a cap and trade covers five states, that's my potential market for my new innovative scrubbing technology. I'm going to be much more likely to make the investment in the new technology if I have a bigger market. And then more players in an emissions trading market make it a better market. In the European market, we talked a little bit about the bad information they had about the emissions baseline, and that really affected how the market performed. Prices were high, they were really low, then the price fell out of the market. If you have a lot of players in your market, you're more likely to have confidence in the price that's set. You'll have more information about the transactions that occur, just like any other commodities market, whether it's pork bellies or anything. The more information you have, the better you are at guessing what the fair price of the commodity is. And correspondingly, the better chance of realizing your goal at the lowest possible price. And more states lessen the potential for leakage. So that refers to the case where one state has a cap and all the states around it do not. And so what happens is the constrained area simply invites more imports, and the emissions that go with those imports are not capped. So the bigger the program, the better in that sense. And then this is just the last point, Madam Chair. In terms of the mechanics and the building blocks of a cap-and-trade program, they're really no different in the regional context, except that what you have is a bunch of state programs that agree to work with each other. So if Minnesota had a program with price per ton of carbon would be around $5, between $5 and $10, between the start, which is early January 2009 through 2015. Now, what does that mean in terms of translating into consumer prices? The residential household in New York was going to see an increase in their electricity bill annually of under $30. So it wasn't a huge hit. However, let me say that that doesn't mean that the same exact program applied in Minnesota or across a bunch of states in the upper Midwest would yield the same cost impact projections. In fact, they would most certainly be different. They could be less, they could be more. And the point there would be that once you have your program designed, you need to analyze what the expected impacts would be. And then you decide whether those are acceptable to you or not. And I would say, generally, the cost that a program imposes on the economy is directly associated with the reductions that you seek to achieve. And any complementary measures that you're able to undertake. So if you're able to stimulate energy efficiency in the electric context at the same time that you reduce emissions, generally you'll find that the price will be the price impact is moderated heavily. But if your focus is purely on emissions and you're not looking for ways to maximize efficiency at the same time, then your impacts will generally, I think, be higher.
And then what happened in Europe?
In Europe, the price went up to like 35 euros at one point, and then the price completely fell out. As soon as the information came out to the people in the marketplace that there were actually more allowances than there were emissions, there was no reason to pay anything for the allowances. You know, they're basically worthless. And so in the first three-year period, which is a trial period, they've called it, the price now for an allowance is essentially zero. But in the second period where they have good emissions information because they've actually had sources monitor the emissions, the price is around 16 euros the last time I checked. So it's, I guess it's about $20.
Representative Bearden, and then again, we do need to move along. I know that this is a very interesting topic. We will revisit it a number of times, but we do have a full agenda, too. We will revisit it.
I'll be brief then, because I'm thinking when we're talking about the price that you threw out, and again, it was just conjecture, that there actually are two other variables that are in there, which gets back to the question we asked a few moments ago. If we fiddle with the standard, that's going to affect the price. And if we monkey with the allotment of pollutants that we allow in a year, that's going to affect the price if we keep changing the benchmarks. That's why I was asking who's setting this and how does that work? Because I can just imagine